south overnight, but weaken considerably as it moves through central and southern England on Friday, turning colder for Scotland with some wintry showers here for a time by Friday afternoon. The weekend will stay cloudy and breezy with rain at times for Scotland and Northern Ireland, but drier and warmer weather across England and Wales. And don't forget that high pressure building into the early half of next week. That's your forecast.
Many thanks, Louise. And we've got the shipping forecast for you in around about 15 minutes' time. But now on Radio 4, Peter Firth reads another essay from James Woods's collection, The Fun Stuff. Tonight he celebrates Pulitzer Prize winner Marilyn Robinson.
Growing up in a religious household, I got used to the sight of priests, but always found them fascinating and slightly repellent. The funereal uniform, supposed to obliterate the self in a shroud of colourlessness, also draws enormous attention to the self. Humility seems to be made out of the same cloth as pride. Since the ego is irrepressible and secular, it tends to bulge in peculiar shapes when religiously depressed. The priests I knew practiced self-abnegation but perfected a quiet dance of ego. They were modest but pompous, gentle but tyrannical, pious but knowing. Most were good men, certainly less venal than the average, but the peculiar constrictions of their calling produced peculiar opportunities for unloosing. This is probably one of the reasons, putting the secular antagonisms of novelists aside, that priests are overwhelmingly seen in fiction as comical, hypocritical, improperly worldly, or a little dim. Another reason is that fiction needs egotism, vanity, venality to produce drama and comedy. The 76-year-old Reverend John Ames, who narrates Marilyn Robinson's second novel, Gilead, is gentle, modest, loving, and above all, good. He's also a bit boring, and boring in proportion to his curious lack of ego. At home in the Iowa town of Gilead in the mid-1950s, aware of his imminent demise, he writes a long letter to his 7-year-old son, which is presented as a series of diary entries. Mellowly resigned, tired but faithful, he is a man who can serenely exclaim, "How I have loved this life," or inform us that he has written 2,000 sermons in the deepest hope and conviction. The reader may roll his eyes at this and think, "All 2,000? Not one of them written in boredom or out of obligation?" Yorick, the parson in Tristram Shandy, who is so impressed with the eloquence of one of his own eulogies that he can't help writing a self-loving bravo on his text, seems closer to the human case and more novelistically vivid. As if sensitive to the piety of Gilead, Robinson subverted this traditional objection by making her novel swerve away from the traditionally novelistic. Ames's calm, grave diary entries contain almost no dialogue, shun scenes, seem to smother conflict before it has taken a breath. Very beautifully, Gilead becomes less a novel than a species of religious writing, poised between homily and home, religious exercise and naturalism. "This morning a splendid dawn passed over our house on its way to Kansas. This morning Kansas rolled out of its sleep into a sunlight grandly announced, proclaimed throughout heaven, one more of the very finite number of days that this old prairie has been called Kansas or Iowa. But it has all been one day. That first day. Light is constant. We just turn over in it. So every day is, in fact, the self-same evening and morning." The result is one of the most unconventional, conventionally popular novels of recent times. Robinson describes herself as a liberal Protestant believer and churchgoer, but her religious sensibility is really far more uncompromising and archaic than this allows. Her essays, selected in the collection The Death of Adam, are theologically tense and verbally lush in a manner almost extinct in modern literary discourse. She is a liberal in the sense that she finds it difficult to write directly about the content of her belief and shuns the evangelical childishness of gluing human attributes onto God. As a child, she felt God as a presence before I had a name for him, and adds that she goes to church to experience moments that do not occur in any other settings. In a way that would seem palatable to many Americans, and certainly to her thousands of liberal readers, her Protestant belief seems born out of a love of religious silence, the mystic, quietly at prayer in an unadorned place, indifferent to ecclesiastical meditation. But she is illiberal and unfashionably fierce in her devotion to this Protestant tradition. She is voluble in defense of silence. She loathes the complacent idleness whereby contemporary Americans dismiss Puritanism and turn John Calvin into an obscure moralizing bigot. We flinch from the Protestant way because it places sin at the center of life. But then, as she tartly reminds us, Americans never think of themselves as sharing fully in the human condition, and therefore are beset as all humankind is beset. She writes in her essay, Puritans and Prigs, "The belief that we are all sinners gives us excellent grounds for forgiveness and self-forgiveness, and is kindlier than any expectation that we might be saints." Nowadays, she argues, educated Americans are prigs, not Puritans, quick to pour judgment on anyone who fails to toe the right political line. Soft moralizing has replaced hard moralizing, but at least those old hard moralists admitted to being moralists. I do not always enjoy Robinson's founded ecstasies, but I admire the obdurateness with which she describes the difficult joys of a faith that will please neither evangelicals nor secularists. Above all, I deeply admire the precision and lyrical power of her language, and the way it embodies a struggle, the fight with words, the contemporary writer's fight with the history of words and the presence of literary tradition, the fight to use the best words to describe both the visible and the invisible world. Here, for instance, is how the narrator of Housekeeping, Robinson's first novel, describes her dead grandmother, who lies in the bed with her arms flung up and her head flung back. "It was as if drowning in air. She had leapt towards ether." In the same novel, the narrator imagines her grandmother pinning sheets to a line on a windy day. "Say that when she had pinned three corners to the lines, it began to billow and leap in her hands, to flutter and tremble, and to glare with light, and that the throes of the thing were as gleeful and strong as if a spirit were dancing in its cerements." Cerements, an old word for burial cloth, is Robinson in her antique mode, and is one of many moments in her earlier work when she sounds like the antiquarian Cormac McCarthy. But stronger than that fancy word is the plain and lovely phrase, "the throes of the thing," with its animism and its homemade alliteration. Her novel Home begins simply, eschewing obvious verbal finesse, and slowly grows in luxury. Its last 50 pages are magnificently moving and richly pondered in the way of Gilead. Home has been presented as a sequel to that novel, but it is more like that novel's brother, since it takes place at the same narrative moment and dovetails with its happenings. In Gilead, John Ames's great friend is the Reverend Robert Boughton, the town's Presbyterian minister. The two men grow up together, confide in each other, and share a wry, undogmatic Protestant belief. But whereas John Ames has married late and has only one son, Reverend Boughton has five children, one of whom is a very prodigal son, Jack Boughton. In Gilead, Ames frets over Jack, now in his 40s, who has been difficult since he was a schoolboy. There has been petty theft, unemployment, alcoholism, and an illegitimate child, now dead, with a local woman. One day, Jack walked out of the Boughton home and stayed away for 20 years, not returning even for his mother's funeral. Recently, we learn from Ames, Jack has unexpectedly returned after all that time away. In the last part of Gilead, Jack comes to Ames for a blessing, for the blessing he cannot get from his own father, and spills a remarkable secret. He has been living with a black woman from Memphis named Della and has a son with her. Home is set in the Boughton household at the time of Jack's sudden return and is an intense study of three people: the Reverend Boughton, the old dying patriarch, his pious daughter, Glory, and prodigal Jack. Robinson evokes well the drugged shuffle of life in a home dominated by the routines of an old parent. How the two middle-aged children hear the creak of bedsprings as their father lies down for his nap, and then, Later, a stirring of bedsprings, then the lisp, lisp of slippered feet and the puck of the cane. The very furniture is oppressive, immovable. The numerous knick-knacks were displayed only as a courtesy to their givers, most of whom by now would have gone to their reward. For Glory, who is in her late 30s, there is the dread that this will be her final home. What does it mean to come home? Glory had always thought home would be a house less cluttered and ungainly than this one, in a town larger than Gilead or a city where someone would be her intimate friend and the father of her children, of whom she would have no more than three. Much of home is devoted to an attempt to puzzle out the mystery of Jack Borton's rebellion, his spiritual homelessness. From earliest years, he had seemed a stranger to relatives. The family had been waiting for him to walk out, and he did. And then this story had become their defining narrative. Even now that he has returned, reflects Glory, there is an incandescence of unease about him whenever he walked out the door. Over the course of the book, we discover a little of what he has been doing in the 20 years away. As in Gilead, we learn about the early illegitimate child and about his 8-year relationship with Della, who is, ironically enough, a preacher's daughter. Father and son clash while watching television news reports of the racial unrest in Montgomery. Old Borton imperiously swats away his son's anger with his bland, milky prophecy.
There's no reason to let that sort of trouble upset you. In 6 months, nobody will remember one thing about it.
If we have read Gilead, we know, as Jack's father does not, why Jack has a special interest in matters of race. As the old man palpably declines, an urgency sets in. The funnel of the narrative of imminent death should insist on forgiveness, but this is precisely what the father cannot allow. Nothing will change, and Jack will leave again, as his father always knew he would. Nothing will change because the family situation rests on a series of paradoxes which interlock to imprison father and son. Jack's soul is homeless, but his soul is his home. For as Jack tells his sister, the soul is what you can't get rid of. He is condemned to leave and return. If the prodigal son is the most loved because most errant, then his errancy is what is secretly loved, even if no one can admit to it. Perhaps a family needs its designated sinner. Everyone longs for restoration, for the son to come home and become simply good, just as everyone longs for heaven, but such restoration, like heaven, is hard to imagine. Behind all of Robinson's works is an abiding interest in the question of heavenly restoration. As she puts it in Housekeeping, there is a law of completion that everything must finally be made comprehensible. What are all these fragments for, if not to be knit up finally? In a last encounter of devastating power, Jack goes to his father to tell him he is going away again. Jack puts out his hand. The old man drew his own hand into his lap and turned away.
Tired of it, he said.
They are the last words the Reverend Borton speaks in this book, an obviously angry inversion of the last tired words of Serene John Ames in Gilead. I'll pray, and then I'll sleep. So luminous are this book's final scenes, so affecting, that it is all the critic can do not to catch from it, as in this review, the contagion of ceaseless quotation, a fond mumbling.
And tomorrow, James Wood examines Ian McEwan's delight in surprising his readers. The Fun Stuff is read by Peter Firth, abridged by Eileen Horn, and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. These notes herald the beginning of Sailing By and the imminent arrival of the shipping forecast.
sailing by. So to the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Thursday, the 6th of March. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Rockall, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. New low moving rapidly northeastwards, expected Malin 1004 by 1800 Thursday. Low 100 miles north of southeast Iceland.